This is WHFR Dearborn. And now it's our public affairs show, the new WHFR Journal, local news and alternative views from Henry Ford Community College. Hello and welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal, local news and alternative views for Dearborn and the surrounding area. That's how local we are, folks, and we're new because, well, it's not the same stuff we talked about last week. And I'm joined in the studio to help with the interviews by Amy Powers, our WHFR News Director, and also Dennis Reimars, our WHFR reporter extraordinaire. Yeah, and your mics aren't on yet, folks, so they can't hear you. But
that's how the show runs.
Nice trick. Are they really there?
There we go. Yeah. See,
we're here.
Okay. But joining the studio, and he has limited amount of time with us today, but it's really quite an honor to have here Dr. Philip Hesburgh, who is the president of the Detroit Institute of Ophthalmology. And he's going to talk about the real honor that we have here at Henry Ford Community College of being the location for a very impressive conference. The easy description is The Eye and the Chip 2010. The subtitle is, now get your pencil and papers out here, folks, 2010 Special Emphasis on Retinal Stimulation Safety for Neuroprosthetic Devices. Now, I'm told that I can actually say this is all about getting close to having a bionic eye device developed. And we're on the cutting edge here. It's an international conference. So welcome, Dr. Hesburgh. How did, first of all, this investigation begin into this kind of neuroprosthetic device?
Well, it's research has probably gone on for 30 to 40 years, but it was only with the real success of the cochlear implant for profoundly deaf people that the number of institutions studying this enlarged to the point where there was a critical mass of people working on. Mm-hmm. A artificial human vision. So now this is the sixth Congress that we've held. All of them have been sponsored by the Detroit Institute of Ophthalmology. All of them have been co-organized by Joseph Rizzo, who is a physician at Harvard Medical School. Mm-hmm. And we have worked with him for the past 12 years. We do it every other year. This is our first time at the Henry Ford
Community College campus.
Right? Yeah. And yeah. We are honored to be here, and we are grateful that Dr. Mee would have us here.
Right. Our president, who we interviewed last week here, and mentioned this too during there. Yeah, so the target audience for the conference it's interesting. It's not just, and again, excuse me for popularizing, but some of our listeners may not know, it's not just people who are doctors that specialize in the treatment of eye problems, but it says electrical and electronic engineers, ophthalmologists, of course, like yourself, optometrists, bioengineers, neurologists, neurosurgeons. So it's all the people that need to share information and give input and also spread the word.
Sure, right? Because really, the retina of the eye is a piece of your brain stuck out on a stalk. And so what we're really talking about is technology like your iPhone interfacing with the tissues of your brain. So, for example, if we take the 114 young men and women who have come back from Iraq or Afghanistan without eyes, the device will have to be placed in the visual cortex of the brain. But young people who have lost their vision from, say, retinitis pigmentosa, or older people who've lost it from macular degeneration, those people have an intact globe, and they have intact communication system between the retina and the visual cortex of the brain. So in those young and elderly people, the device can be placed in the eye. So so the research involves all kinds of people. It involves bioengineers who can look at a device like this and say, okay, this has many microelectrodes. How long can they be in human tissue and still function? Mm-hmm. Because these are active devices. Right. They're not passive devices.
They're going to need electricity of some sort.
Yes, they are. Sure. That's right. They have to take the image as sent to it from a camera built in the eyeglasses. Right. And then an electrical input is radioed to the inside of the eye and picked up by the ganglion cells of the retina, which then transport this electrical image to the visual cortex of the brain, which is way in the very most posterior section
this
of the
brain. This is exciting research. I, of course, remember, I read a lot, watch a lot of science fiction movies and TV shows and that. And Bionic Woman, she had a bionic eye. Of course, it looked like a regular eye. We couldn't tell. Right now, again, this is a state-of-the-art technology, and it's not able to be put into the average patient, no matter how much money you have. It's close to, is it completing trials or starting trials?
Well,
worldwide?
Okay. We're now at the stage where several different research groups have either received or are applying to the Food and Drug Administration, the United States FDA, mm-hmm. for permission to put in prototype devices for testing purposes. Mm. And some of these are here in the United States under our FDA, but because of the influence of the cochlear implant for the profoundly deaf,
mm-hmm. That's inside the
middle
ear.
That's in the brain, but that's not a hearing aid. It's a neurosensory device in the tissue of the brain.
Right.
Most of that technology developed from programs in Australia, and because of that, the Australians have very active research going on this device for the blind, which is analogous. Mm-hmm. And similarly, the group in California called Second Sight is funded by one of the developers of the American version of the cochlear implant. So that company derives in a linear fashion from deafness.
This is so exciting, and you've been working on it yourself, I guess, for years. You were telling a story how famous radio legend J.P. McCarthy from WJR.
During his lifetime, he was always a big backer of the Detroit Institute of Ophthalmology, and he had a clinical problem which ultimately would have required a very sophisticated level of these devices. Mm. Let me just explain that a little bit. Initially, the people who will get these devices will be younger people who have had the congenital disorder retinitis pigmentosa. And those young people begin to lose their night vision and their side vision in their 20s and 30s. And very often, a very high percentage of them are totally blind by the time that they're in their 40s or 50s. Mm-hmm. They have a long time to get ready for blindness. It comes on in a very gradual way. And we will probably be giving them the first implants. Mm-hmm. Because they're totally blind. We can't hurt their eye anymore.
When you say implants, I think you mentioned before that you're wearing glasses physically for the chip part, the camera part, and then it's connected by wires, electrodes somehow into the brain.
Right. But
it's not. Is it wireless?
It's wireless.
Oh, it's even better. It's not as icky at all.
Iteration of this, there was a device which was placed in a Korean War veteran by an investigator at Columbia University that had a group of wires like a garden hose that came out of the back of his brain. So many people who look at the internet think that that's what's going to happen to me. I'm going to have this big wired interface. That's totally dead technology.
Well, I just have a couple of questions to sum up here. We're talking with Dr. Hesburgh, who is a distinguished doctor of ophthalmology and head of the Detroit Institute of Ophthalmology here, which is sponsoring, along with Henry Ford Community College, this this conference coming up on September 13th, 14th, and 15th for professionals in this area, which could lead to, I guess, right, eliminating blindness, maybe a couple of decades.
That, there will always be some blindness that we won't be able to help. Young people born blind, okay, if the brain hasn't learned to use input,
I see,
this will not give them vision any more than we can take someone who is congenitally profoundly deaf. Okay. If they haven't learned to hear, the cochlear implant gives them gibberish, which just drives them.
Well, you know, you don't want that, of course. But this is a wonderful breakthrough, and we hope everything proceeds can proceed quickly. Now, these when they pass their clinical their trials right now, they're testing, and they get to, you said, the clinical stage. What's the next stage after the? I mean, there are going to be some test implants, you said.
Right. What will happen when the Food and Drug Administration has two main initiatives. One of them is on drugs, and the other side is on devices. Mm. So the device section of the Food and Drug Administration will look at this carefully over the next year, 2-3 years. And if it likes what it sees with the prototypes, then it will give an approval for the device manufacturers to begin letting retinal surgeons put these into the eye, or neurosurgeons putting them into the brain.
Do you think healthcare is going to, health insurance is going to pay for this stuff eventually?
I'm very worried about that.
Yeah?
I'm very worried about that.
Yeah, it's extraordinary technology. Obviously, the better we get at it, the more we learn, the cost can come down probably. But
the way this Congress works is that that we know that collegiality facilitates cooperation.
Exactly.
And that cooperation accelerates progress. So for the last 12 years, we've been bringing the leaders in. Now they know each other. And now we've got people from Australia working with the Americans, and we've got Germans working with the Koreans, and we've got the Japanese working with another American group. So we know that collegiality facilitates collaboration. So
well, Dr. Hesburgh, thank you so much for coming here again. Say yes to Detroit. We're on the leading edge of bringing people together and developing this research, and we hope for all the people that need to regain their sight, certainly, that are losing their sight now, that this can be a real answer for them in maybe the next decade. I mean, obviously, it's not something right away, and they can't go and ask their doctors about it, but it's you know, the sense of sight is a very important element to the way we relate to the world.
Actually, it's probably of interest to you that that this has a radio announcer series in that or at least import in that. Yeah. Rush Limbaugh went totally deaf.
Yes, I remember. Yes.
And after he went deaf, he had cochlear implants.
Oh,
and with them, he hears perfectly. And that stimulated an awful lot of people in the neurosensory world to say,
right,
we ought to be working on this.
If they can get the sound waves that go into your ear into electrochemical kind of signal that can connect with your brain, then the eye, through like a video camera, that signal can connect. So that's a connection you've been making.
That's the connection. Vision is immensely more complex than hearing.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
But what it did, the Limbaugh story, convinced us that we were on the right track.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you for all your efforts and work and continued success with this new technology and development. Dr. Hesburgh, thank you for being on the new WHFR Journal today.
And thank you to Henry Ford Community College.
You're very welcome. We're going to have a couple of public service announcements here and be back with more local news and alternative views.
Henry Ford Community College Theater Arts proudly presents Suburbia, August 19th through 21st and August 26th through 28th. The play is a hard-hitting commentary on American culture and is directed by Christopher Bremer. Suburbia chronicles the nighttime activities of a group of aimless 20-somethings and their reunion with a high school classmate who has become a successful musician. All shows are at 8 p.m. and tickets are only $12 for adults and $10 for students. Call 313-845-9817 for more information. That's 313-845-9817 for Suburbia at Henry Ford Community College in Dearborn. Some adult content, parental caution advised.
Hi, professional skateboarder Tony Hawk here with Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you'll have the energy to skate through anything.
Nice play on words, Doc.
That's how I roll, Bugs. So whether you like to work the half pipe,
now that's catching air,
kick the soccer ball around, or dance in your room,
just move it your way
for an hour a day.
The way you like to move, as long as you're moving.
Carve out some time every day and get active. Because it's time to do a 180 on what you think exercise is.
Because it can be whatever you want it to be. So be a player.
Be a player.
Get up and play an hour a day, Doc. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
At www.letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
D101 is open for your dining pleasure in the Student and Culinary Arts Center on Henry Ford Community College's main campus in Dearborn. 5101 offers a fresh, innovative approach to fine dining with all entrees made from the freshest ingredients with weekly specialties highlighting different countries and cultures. For hours of operation or to make reservations, please call 313-206-5101. That's 313-206-5101. 5101, an elegant dining experience at an affordable price.
Come hear the excitement. Come hear the music. Come hear Belle Isle. Saturday, August 28th from 1 to 7 p.m. Come to the Remick Music Shell on Belle Isle to hear some of the hottest bands from Detroit and around the state. Like the Sykes, the High Strung, the Maunder Minimum, Champions of Breakfast, Chris Bathgate, Loon, Doop, and the Inside Outlaws, Copper Thieves, and more. Proceeds from the event will go to the restoration and preservation of America's largest city island park, Belle Isle. Plus, learn how you can get involved with your community. Nonprofits from all over Detroit will be showcasing ways to get involved in their organizations. Listen to great music. Help preserve Belle Isle. Rediscover Detroit. And get involved with your community. Saturday, August 28th from 1 to 7 p.m. at the Remick Music Shell on Belle Isle. For more information, visit facebook.com/comehearbelleisle or visit our partners, the Friends of Belle Isle at fobi.org.
This is the new WHFR Journal for August 27th, 2010. How is everyone doing out there? Enjoying the fantastic weather we're having right now today in Dearborn. Not too hot out there, just right. And hope you're enjoying your time. Labor Day weekend next weekend, so I guess a lot of people are planning ahead. Remember, you should not leave until this show is finished. Or be sure to take an internet-connected device so you can listen to the podcast. But just joking about
that. Or download
that.
It once you get to your destination.
There you go.
But some of us, at least I am going to be here anyway, catching up on the news. Here's just some headlines, and I'll see whether or not Amy and Dennis want to jump in here. In the Press and Guide from last Sunday, this is the August 22nd edition. On the front page, a story about, and this, I think we missed it a week or so ago since last week we spent the whole hour talking with our very, very intelligent, smart, quick, and verbal president, Dr. Gail Mee here at Henry Ford. But in Dearborn, St. Sebastian Church, which is a Catholic church, and I don't quite remember where it is, but it's somewhere in Dearborn. There's a controversy about Dearborn Heights. Is it a church bell ringing too loudly and disturbing people in the community? And I'm sure that'll get worked out one way or the other, back and forth. I was wondering, and it just struck me today, of course, there were controversies about tower bells in East Dearborn a few years ago from some of the mosques. You know, when you have to pray five times a day, and the first one is early morning, or it's 5 a.m. or what it is, and people were complaining in those neighborhoods about that signal coming from the mosque. How was that resolved? I don't know. Dennis doesn't live in East Dearborn. No. I live there, but I never heard them in the first place. I don't remember the issue coming up. To East Dearborn.
Not the resolution.
But I'm just saying it must have been resolved with the community. Either people moved out or the mosques found a way to cut the volume down, or maybe they just eliminated that. If you're practicing that religion devoutly, you don't need a reminder. I wouldn't think that you'd have your own little clock, or you set your own alarm or something. You shouldn't need the building to remind you. You'd be self-sufficient, more or less. But although a nice service if the community was totally Islamic and practiced that to send that. So I think it'll get worked out. But it's just interesting that it's, you know, these days people, I don't want to get into the mosque thing in New York City, because first of all, folks, it's not a mosque. It's a cultural center they're talking about building. There are mosques already there, only four blocks. There have been mosques there originally only four blocks away from the so-called Ground Zero. This is a cultural center. It was approved by everybody, including Fox News and Laura Ingraham 6 months ago. There was a wonderful idea to get, there's Jewish communities and other people involved in that community center. It's not just Islamic. And it was a wonderful idea 6 months ago, and nothing's changed, except Fox News decided to do a twist and turn and make it a headline, and then they started ranting and raving. And then, of course, everybody says, oh, I don't like that. You don't even know what you're talking about, Fox News, I guess, because it's not even a mosque there. But the community here in Dearborn is able to work things out and respect each other, I think, in the morning, when the bells start ringing. I don't know when San Sebastian's bells are ringing. Was that in the morning? It doesn't matter. I'm just saying.
Went to school there, it was in the morning.
These are common issues. When there's disputes like this, you just work it out. You give feedback. Sure, you might want to get the newspaper involved, to expand the community of input. But it nothing bad with having the story in the paper, because more people can speak their opinions, and it'll probably cause the issue to be resolved, more quickly. It's called socialization, folks. That's even what this show does. We get the ideas out there. You can agree or disagree and talk it over and make input to your elected officials, perhaps, or the people involved in St. Sebastian Church, and it'll work out. I'm sure that'll work out. From the same paper, the Arab American National Museum, next week, it's actually Thursday night, but they're sponsoring a film and a dinner. And, of course, it's Ramadan right now, which means that the faithful in Islamic religion are not going to be eating during the daylight hours. So they will be serving, they'll be showing a movie first, a film about a Pakistani woman. And it's very highly regarded, great movie. And it's a benefit, I think, for the museum. It's $25 a person. It's not cheap. But then they have a break the fast dinner afterwards, and everyone's invited. In fact, the article in the Press and Guide was so wonderful and all inclusive. In fact, we've had some of the end of Ramadan feasts here in our student center, Henry Ford Community College. We may have one again this year. I'm not sure when Ramadan ends this year, unfortunately, which I apologize, but I don't think I'm required to know that. But I'm just saying, always very inclusive and open if you want to find things out, if you want to participate. So great movie and probably a great dinner at the Arab American National Museum next Thursday night. Starts at 6 p.m., I think, the whole event. More information, you can go to the Arab American National Museum website. Just Google AANM. You might even get there. But what are the odds there's some other organization that's using AANM, the American Association of New Mexicans,
sure,
or something. Yeah, okay. Well, just give him a call right here in Dearborn. Okay. We found out that Jim Schoolmaster, who is the incumbent on the Dearborn Public Schools Board of Education, his position is up for Well, his term is up in November, and he is running again. We know that, and also a Roxine McDonald is running against him. So, just one seat there, and who is Roxine McDonald, you ask? Well, I have the answer for you. I know you want to know. I can't tell you much, but I can tell you this. She is the mother of three sons, two still in Dearborn Public Schools and one serving in the military. She's a former vice president of the Dearborn Parent Teacher Student Association, the PTSA. In my day, it was just the PTA, but now they've included students. Well, as if they have some involvement in this education thing. You know,
it's only about them. Yeah, I get
some
it.
Way to give input there outside the school building. And that's great. And Roxanne has also served 4 years on Nolan PTA's executive board. She's lived most of her life in Dearborn, graduated from Dearborn High, and earned two associate degrees from Henry Ford Community College. One was not enough. You just like Cracker Jack, you just can't get enough. Or is it Chinese food? You're just hungry after you, after you eat it.
Yeah, I got that degree.
Yeah. But,
another one now.
No, it's great. She also ran in 2009 seeking one of 2,000 open board seats, so you may recognize her name there. Schoolmaster, of course, just to give equal attention here, and he has always been a very easy person to talk to, communicating with the radio station and the community. And I can't make any other comments, but I'm just saying that he's a practicing attorney. He's seeking his fourth term on the board. He chairs the board's finance committee. Mm. His two children graduated from Dearborn High School, and his wife, Darlene, was a longtime teacher in the district. Crestwood, Westward Heights, and Dearborn Heights District 7 do not have elections this fall, folks. So this is the only school board election that'll be coming up November 2nd
is the Tuesday.
Yes, Tuesday, November 2nd. So make sure you're registered by October 2nd. That's coming up too. So that's the challenge in the Dearborn board. Got to make a choice there, folks. Okay. A couple stories we mentioned, I think, briefly in headlines that the Dearborn Heights former land that they had an incinerator, a trash incinerator on, has now, that purchase has been okayed by Dearborn Heights. And all we knew was that they were thinking of a solar panel farm generating electricity for some of the 30-plus acres and a TV studio. Well, it turns out that now we know it's a film and TV studio. So I don't know what size. I don't say what size the building is, but you know, a lot of things can be done very well inside a soundstage, as they call it. You know, walls can be built and ceilings and decor. It can even make it look like through the magic of movies. Maybe just blue screen. They just paint a blue wall, and then they can do Avatar over again in Dearborn Heights, you know, or something like that. Yeah, it's interesting. It's a Canadian from Windsor that has bought the land now and is trying to set this up. Again, our tax credits in Michigan. Michigan is the place to come for making movies. Something like 60% rebate on the cost of your movie at the end of the year, at the end of that tax year. Off the top, 60%. So if you're making a $50 million movie, then the state of Michigan supposedly would pony up $30 million? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's how, if it is 60, I think it's only 45%, but still, but yeah. almost half of the money you get back, and it has to be qualified. You just can't start making it and then ask for the money
back.
You have to go through stages of approval. I don't know if they're acquiring Michigan content or Michigan participation. Usually states do that. You have to hire so many of the crew and or actors, and I don't know what the rules are, but that only makes sense that a large percentage of the film shot here is also going to employ people in the skilled trades appropriate who are already here in Michigan. And of course that would save them money rather than shipping them in from Hollywood or New York or something anyway. And so that's good. And that's the extra details on the Heights Incinerator project. TV film studio at some point may be there. Obviously they still have to get projects to put in there, but a Canadian. Interestingly.
And also part of the plan is a strip mall along Inkster Road.
Yeah, interesting. I heard that too, yeah.
Okay, well, then so now I know I'm in Michigan.
If you love stripping folk, no, if you love a variety of malls. Small vendor malls where you can, it's not an inside. I mean, a strip mall means it's sure. You park in the lot and you just walk right, and all the buildings are right in a row there and easy to get to and so on. So why not? I mean, if they're on one of the major roads, location is everything, it makes sense to maybe rent out some space for a strip mall, which I, again, just don't like calling it a strip mall, but nothing against people who strip for a living, necessarily, in the right places where it's legal, if you have a permit. Yes, well, for consenting adults.
He's from Windsor.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
We'll just call it a row of shops from now on.
Yeah, row of shops.
The promotion for the environmental roundtable meeting from Wednesday night was in last Sunday's Press and Guide. Dennis himself attended.
I did, by myself.
Can you? No one else came?
No. I mean,
no from the station. From the I could station. Not make it. I felt very bad. It was the first night of meetings here.
For both of you.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Jay and Amy signs on each side of him.
I did. Reserved.
Yeah. Appreciate that. But didn't give us a summary. It was like the second meeting of people from the community. Not necessarily. This was, again, an idea that was begun with the Sierra Club and various stakeholders. These are the stakeholders, not a vampire killer, by the way. Folks.
Right. The difference this time is we actually had a field trip outdoors and we walked around because this one was at the Interpretive Center.
Yeah, which the Environmental Interpretive
Center. Thank you, which is the western, I don't know, what is it, the northwest of U of M D.
Northwest corner.
That's right. And we went outside and we looked at some of the different things that they're doing there, one of them being a rain garden. I'm sure you guys are familiar with this.
No, I'm not.
Basically, they it's strategically placed so when the rainwater is coming down, the garden absorbs a lot of the water, including the pollutants and some of the different things. So when it does get to the sewer, it's substantially less water.
Okay.
And it's filtered. Great idea. So we walked around, we looked at the plots that they have that they actually rent out to citizens. Of course, there's a long waiting list. They said there's 50 plots there that people can rent. There's 50 people on the waiting list, and it generally is about that. But we had a great visit.
Sorry, is that for farming or the afterlife?
That's urban farming.
Okay.
Right in the, oh, you're funny. Out there where they're actually building or growing a lot of different things, and they have a part in the back just for kids, where the kids are learning too.
That's great.
But we also were visited by Dave Norwood, who we've had on our show here, and he's the sustainability coordinator for the city.
That's right.
And he spoke with, for about maybe 20 minutes to a half hour. It was just amazing.
Which just stuck in my mind after reviewing that interview from 2 weeks ago with Dave Norwood, that he has a staff of none.
Right.
And he has a budget of zero.
He creates his own budget.
Yeah, he has to get grants or coordinate other things at the city. So you can't exactly say the city's made a commitment there, but they pay his paycheck. So
they do.
And
I think they do. He's not doing
program.
It for free, right? Sustainability coordinator of Dearborn.
But they are pursuing this program.
Yes,
and
they
I
are
think
supporting
that's commendable
it.
Oh, yeah. For and there,
he
the
was there in
level
attendance.
State government.
He spoke for it with.
Yes, he was the key speaker.
And it was actually the city was out there. So, folks, if you want an idea of what happened, they did actually come out and record it. They taped the when Mr. Norwood gave his presentation, and some of the they got some B-roll footage from where we were outside and everything. And I think I'm in a couple of those shots. So we'll have to.
And that'll be cable.
Probably cable television, the city channel,
the city
CTV,
channel.
Or whatever they're calling
it. It is. It's exactly right. Anyway, so so he, like you said, Jay, I mean, he doesn't have a budget. I mean, he's sustaining his job basically on his own effort. No, that's not a pun. But he's doing some amazing things, and he answered questions, and there were so many, really. I mean, we have a whole room full of either organizations that are committed to a more green or a better environment, or actually the citizens who are the same.
So where does it go from here?
We'll have a third meeting. We haven't decided exactly the date or the time, the time or the place. Mm-hmm. I have a feeling we'll end up back at the Interpretive Center. It was just a real good environment, and we'll keep listeners posted.
Do they have their own free parking there, or just use that lot that's nearest to them?
Those parking structures free for visitors. That's a visitor lot.
Oh, it is. Parking structure at U of MD, that's the closest one. It's just
a three-minute walk
a little bit east there.
Exactly.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's good. I didn't know that. All right.
Of course, I went even greener and stayed in my parking spot here at HFCC.
Yeah, just walk across, over. Of course. Yeah, we're right next door. Well, that's a great effort. So they agreed after talking to talk some more.
Well, and some, yeah, but I mean, I think it's more along the lines of what the city's doing, and we've talked about the new parking lot over at the old Montgomery Ward. So that's
this is informational, of course, so that everybody can be part of it.
What's that structure called over there? I know that it's being built for Midwest Health, but whatever the new one where the old Montgomery Ward's
building
is. Some
sort of Dearborn Town Center.
That's it. Your favorite name for it.
Yeah.
They do, in fact, have the 10 spots where you can charge your car, and they're talking about what, of course, it makes sense for the city to go with green vehicles. So they're talking about eventually, a hybrid for Ford because they have to use Ford.
Yeah, but Ford doesn't have a plug-in hybrid. So you can't, the first Ford that'll be apparently able to be plugged into anything is the electric powered version of the next Ford Focus.
Exactly right.
Which is the end of 2011. Maybe we'll see the electric powered here, or certainly they're saying at the latest the electric powered version of that new Ford Focus will be January of 2012.
Right.
So a little ways away, and I can see people lining up now to get those 10 plugs. I mean, all of a sudden, I predict a deluge.
Yeah.
As soon as the Nissan Leaf is available, and yes, our listeners should know I had to cancel my reservation for one because I need a car in December when my other lease is up, and they couldn't get it here that quick. Although it might be here, they might have them available in Dearborn, they say, by middle of next year. It'll beat the Ford Focus Electric, and it's gotten good reviews already. It's been tested in England, the Nissan Leaf. Yeah. And I don't want to be anti-American here, but most cars are made with worldwide supply of parts. I think the question is, where do they build it, if that matters.
Where it's disassembled, right? That's how they determine.
This is assembled in Japan right now, but I think it's going to be assembled down in Alabama at a Nissan plant.
That's what I read, too, yeah.
Yeah, when it gets rolling. The prototypes came from Japan. Anyway, we'll keep you informed, folks, and we'll be sending our reporters. I hope it's not always on Wednesday nights when I have the WHFR meeting, because I'd really like to go to hear what's happening. But we'll send a reporter one way or the other.
Oh, yeah. I go out there, and they just all got up and clapped and said, Dennis.
Yeah, of course.
Okay, not really. But they do have food there, so you
I think
know,
you
Jen.
Walked in right behind Dave Norwood.
Food. Yeah. When they clapped, right, right. No, just it was a really good experience, and obviously we could use a whole show to talk about it. So just show up. Right?
Well, keep us informed, and of course maybe there'll be a story or you follow this to a certain extent in the new revitalized and updated Mirror newspaper,
which is being delivered as we speak.
Oh, the first issue.
First issue is here today.
Oh, boy. Very exciting. Is that going to be only at the college, or are you thinking of some off-campus distribution points?
Off-campus, for sure.
Excellent.
So we'll be out there. And at our two other satellite campuses, on East and over in Dearborn Heights.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll be everywhere.
Yes. Our new East campus.
That's right.
We just discovered the name of it 2 weeks ago, and Dr. Mee told us about it on the side of the old rotunda.
That's right.
A big sort of banquet facility that had great Christmas pageants. They had it all decorated like a winter wonderland.
Really?
With animated motorized Santas and things. And this was in the 50s. Yeah, it was something. Everybody at Christmas time in the 50s would line up, and it seemed like we stood in line for an hour or so outside the rotunda, and then go inside and walk around, see all the displays, and it was just really fantastic. One is coming up here in Detroit that's somewhat similar, Festival of Trees. We're going to talk about
that. Not in Detroit,
later.
That'll be here in Dearborn.
Yes, it's going to be in Dearborn, but Detroit area.
Right, right.
That should be, if not equal, somewhat similar. But,
right.
The rotunda burned down. There was some accident. The whole place was a disaster, so Ford just raised it, which means lowered it to the ground. And then the M-Tech Center grew up a couple years ago, and the Ford Daycare Center, which is now a daycare center run by University of Michigan Dearborn. Mm. So it's not on the U of MD campus anymore. It's over there.
On Schaefer.
Wait a minute. No. That's our School of Nursing.
The
Ford Daycare Center became the School of Nursing, but there was another child care facility that Ford built next to Etzel Ford High School, and that has been taken over now by U of MD for their child care facility starting this fall. I know because my granddaughter is going there.
Interesting.
So Ford, I guess, it just got out of the child care business.
Okay.
And they have these beautiful new small elementary school type buildings, and so they're going one place or other. So Henry Ford Community College School of Nursing is in the one next to the M-Tech Center,
right?
Starting this fall, and the one next to Etzel Ford is the U of MD Child Care Center. So, let's keep recycling these buildings. Don't let them fall apart.
No, definitely.
Probably the big controversy this week, if you want to call it that, just shows, if you read it in detail, it's hilarious. At the one of our Dearborn Commission meetings, the Civil Service Commission, This is supposed to be sort of an independent group. A couple members are appointed by the mayor. Michael Berry is one of them. There's a picture of them here in the Times Herald from 2 days ago, Wednesday, August 25th edition. But the issue this time was a motion that came on the floor to fire the city's human resources director, which is a civil service position. That person is Val Murphy Goodrich. The story has twists and turns as to how this came about. And it is absolutely crazy, the minutiae here. Now, this commission, and looks like, you know, they all look like nice people from the picture. Of course, what can you tell from a picture? Hitler looked nice, too, except for that mustache. You know, but nobody's got a mustache in this picture. But they got into this whole question about seating Marge Powell as a member of the commission. Remember Marge Powell, former city councilman, even ran for mayor once in Dearborn. City council person. And she was appointed but didn't get sworn in or something to this a couple of years ago. And Tom Tofelsky, I'm going to recap a couple of months ago off the top of my head. Tofelsky discovered that she wasn't officially there because she hadn't been sworn in. So could they swear her in yet? There was a big to-do. Yes, no, maybe, no, we can't. And now the council was going to have a special hearing on that. Was it sometime this month? I don't know how the Marge Powell thing has worked out. Unbelievable, they had to postpone the discussion of whether or not to seat Marge Council. Even the city attorney, Deborah Walling, said Council can just go and say she can take the oath now, even though it's a lot later.
Right.
And just everything is still legitimate from what she voted on for those 2 years.
Just a formality is what they're saying.
Well, but it's ex post facto. I mean, sure. She was appointed, but she voted on a bunch of things without actually officially having been sworn in.
Right.
And so, but the city attorney said, I mean, who's going to sue? So the city attorney thought, we're safe here.
It's legal, too,
if the council wants to do it. She had the appointment, so what the heck. And now these same people, unfortunate group of the Civil Service Commission, felt that there was a political conflict of interest, that the head of HR is supposed to be above politics.
Right.
And for a while, again, this is Valerie Murphy Goodrich, decided to run for a position or whatever that would have been political. And then she realized the conflict and didn't go ahead with it. But because she considered it for a while, they felt that she should be removed. And they asked her to resign. She didn't. And so at the meeting, somebody said, you're fired. I motioned that you're fired. Oh my gosh, back and forth. It's just hilarious and pathetic in a way to read this in the Times Herald, and it's also in the Press and Guide. In fact, the Press and Guide title for the story, which I thought was telling, Civil Service Commission Members Not Very Civil.
Awesome.
This is small town politics.
Yes.
Although Dearborn isn't necessarily that small a town, but this is how it sometimes goes. I think it's really a tempest in a teapot here. Personally, as I read it, I don't think the HR director, who is not criticized here with not doing her job satisfactorily at all, just for a while she was considering doing something political, and then she went, when she realized or somebody informed her, she didn't even go through with it. But because she considered it even a little bit, the commission felt she should resign. Well, that's kind of strict construction of the rules, but they are our commission, of course. Well, then they tried to fire her, and they're not firing her now, and it's postponed again, so I don't know where it's going to go. It's unbelievable. Michael Berry was sort of he tried to be a calming element there. He's not the chairperson. Kathy Mackey, I think, is the chair of the Dearborn Civil Service Commission. And it just was really sort of unfortunate interaction among this relatively small group. It's supposed to be non-political, and all their decisions should be, I think, just logical and objective in terms of how people are doing their jobs, and just got a little out of hand there. So if you want a few laughs and you want to cry a little bit about how these things can get bent out of shape, I don't think the papers, you know, sometimes I criticize the national media and especially the cable television networks for exaggerating or manufacturing an idea to make it scandalous or you know, to get the ratings up and so on. And that's not what's happening here with the Times Herald, the Press and Guide. It just was a very bad scene, and it was all documented, recorded by two reporters, two different papers, and you can read it for yourself in either paper there. A former opponent, Republican, in the last primary, is trying to sue John Dingell. Mulhaney is the man's last name, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, and I think he was involved with the group that was trying to pass out flyers, Christian flyers, at the Arab International Festival, Arab American International Festival. I think that's the same name. But anyway, he was one of four Republicans in the Republican primary, and John Dingell was in the, you know, unopposed on the Democratic side. Mm-hmm. He lost. He came out with the least votes in the Republican primary. But he's claiming that John Dingell stole his campaign slogan.
His slogan, yeah. Hmm. Yeah.
Did John Dingell even have a campaign slogan?
Wasn't it just do it?
Well, he didn't really need to have one
there?
Right now.
Yeah.
The slogan is, make it in America. Make it in America. And as J. Patrick Pepper, good for him, investigative reporter, I think he's the only reporter, for the Times Herald,
right.
He did the research and he said, look, in Washington, D.C., the Democrats in general have been using this phrase, make it in America, since House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Democrat, California, outlined the campaign in early July.
Okay. Hmm.
So did Nancy Pelosi steal this from Mulhaney?
Wow.
Boy.
Mugni, I'm sorry, M-O-U-G-H-N-I, Majed Mugni. But he's filed a lawsuit. Of course, he's a lawyer, so anybody, it's America, God bless
right.
America, anybody can sue anybody for any reason at any time.
Especially when you lose.
You may not win, but it seems like the evidence, as even J. Patrick Pepper can find it here, clearly shows that the Democrats were kicking it around as their general Democratic slogan for their programs in Washington, D.C., way back in early July. And, in fact, a press release Pepper found from July 22nd, where Pelosi was quoted as saying and including it. And the release describes Make It in America, that phrase, as a, quote, new strategy to create blah, 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 blah. Okay, so, I mean, she identified it as a slogan, as a strategy. And, well, anybody can sue anybody at any time, so good luck with that. But, you know, I don't know what he would benefit from that. Does he think he's going to raise his name recognition on the next Republican primary?
It's entirely possible.
Since he came out last? I mean, he's going to be just laughed out of court with, I mean, if this evidence is true that J. Patrick Pepper found, then I don't think he's, as they say, got a leg to stand on, but I'm not a lawyer. So.
He has his name in the paper, though, doesn't he, right
It's now? Wonderful we have a country where we can do that. We are the most litigious country in the world, which means everybody is suing somebody almost all the time. And they say in Hollywood, and this is no joke, that you're not famous. You haven't made it in Hollywood as a big star unless you are being sued and you are suing others at any point in time.
I told you.
That's a key criteria to whether or not you have achieved fame. Is anybody suing you? No, then you're not famous enough yet.
Wow. That was hard work.
Right. Because they're jealous or greedy or whatever, or they want you to settle out of court, you know, for a few bucks. And I don't think Dingell's going to settle out of court on that one. Wyandotte. Remember, we talked about Wyandotte and all their initiatives for power savings with Dave Norwood. Wyandotte, right here in the Times Herald, is investigating and very close to building a biomass power facility. Yeah. Yeah. Page 3A. Okay. You want no more information about that? Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Here it is. As Dave Norwood said, Wyandotte has a history of doing things for themselves, cable television and so on. And city council members on Monday, it'll be Monday of, oh, I don't know when this paper went to press, maybe Monday of last week. But anyway, unanimously approved a letter of understanding between the city and Environmental Generation Technology Advisor, LLC. That's a long name,
yeah.
For an alternative energy park on part of the city-owned property at 4800 Central. BASF Corporation will review and approve the terms of the lease, which may include an oversight provision. I guess it's on or near BASF property.
They're right, and BASF takes a lot of space up there in the river.
Yeah.
By the hospital.
And what is this? Well, basically, it's turning trash into gas. or more specifically, biomass, as they call trash, into syngas, synthetic gas, which can be used to fuel an electrical power plant.
Ooh. We like that, don't we?
So, hey, you know, we're running out of place for our trash, and trash, in many cases, is organic. It is burnable.
Right.
Of course, you have to have filters and ways to make sure that the fumes aren't going to be a problem for the environment. But here, a letter of understanding. And what's going to happen? Well, they're going to send the electricity back into the grid, and primarily to reduce the cost of energy. As I say here, that's power purchase agreement, which will enable it to receive renewable energy credits for electricity generated using syngas. And so it'll benefit the city and the people there, and it makes use of this stuff that we normally just throw away and try to cover up somewhere. So kudos to Wyandotte and all their initiatives in this direction. I really, even though Mayor Guido talked about, and we talked about this with Dave Norwood, and he didn't directly respond, so I assume it's not on the table. Mayor Guido, for the last several years of his term in office, was talking about getting wind turbines, a whole group of them, built down on the Rouge River to efficiently send electrical power back into the grid for the benefit of the city of Dearborn. And today, with the high tech of these things, it certainly would be possible.
Well, you know, and that came up at the sustainability panel on Wednesday when one of the guests asked if we can go off-grid. He said, with electric, yes, we can. We can for sure, but the problem is the limit of the height of the windmills.
In the New York Times today, just briefly, in California, now the United States military has made an official protest against wind farms.
Really?
Well, it looks like terrorist planes are coming over. We can't tell the difference between a 400-foot high, this is 400-foot high wind turbine on these farms, and their propellers and airplanes.
Wow.
Do they really think, I mean, a wind farm has got like dozens and dozens of these towers. What is that, a fleet of terrorist planes which never move?
And aren't on radar? Interesting.
No, radar will pick it up. Yeah. That's what they're saying.
Oh, no
kidding.
It'll
mess up their radar. But they're not moving.
Yeah.
What, they think it's a UFO just hovering there? I mean, what is it? A bunch of helicopters just hovering constantly, day and night, whenever the wind blows?
That's not much of a threat.
U.S. military wants them to stop and demolish the wind farms they already got in these several places in California.
Yeah. How about re-education?
Give me a break.
Yeah.
Give me a break here. Is our military going crazy? Well, a lot of people say that about the Army Corps of Engineers. There's a couple of stories here, but one thing we're doing as a promotion at WHFR is we're helping to try to raise the attention on a commercial movie, but we're giving away free tickets. The movie is one time only. It's going to be at the Birmingham Theater in downtown Birmingham, appropriately named, this coming Monday. That's August 30th at 7 p.m. and 9:30. We've got three pairs of tickets, which we're going to give away during the blues show that follows this one from 2 to 4 o'clock today. And if there's any available, we'll keep offering this deal until the three pairs are gone. This is documentary is about Katrina in New Orleans, and it's entitled The Big Uneasy.
That's right.
As you folks know, The Big Easy is sort of a nickname for New Orleans, Narlins. And this is produced by Harry Shearer, the voice on The Simpsons and other comedy enterprises. We actually carried Harry Shearer's hour-long commentary, news commentary show here on WHFR for a while, but you can get it harryshearer.com or kcrw.com on the internet. The point is, he put a lot of money and time. He lives, one of his homes, main homes, is in New Orleans, into researching this. Scientists and many people, what happened in Katrina and what's the aftermath? And today, so I hope you can get up there to see it, whether you get our free tickets or not, because I'm sure one reason it's one night only around the U.S. is because he couldn't find a distributor.
Right.
And why not? Because it's criticizing the Army Corps of Engineers like crazy.
Yeah.
And ooh, we don't want to criticize the government and seem unpatriotic. They did a terrible job, as he documents in this film. And I've already heard the evidence, and I've read the four pages that came with it. But he's got the evidence there. You make your own mind up about it. But the levees were not ready for Hurricane Katrina. That should be obvious. The aftermath was an absolute disaster on the part of FEMA, the Army Corps of Engineers, and, of course, the federal government under President Bush, and he documents all this. And today, in today's New York Times, tales of post-Katrina chaos go from rumor to fact. New Orleans. In the days after Hurricane Katrina left much of New Orleans in flooded ruins, the city was awash in tales of violence and bloodshed. The narrative of those early chaotic days, built largely on half-baked anecdote and unfounded rumor, quickly hardened into a kind of ugly consensus. Poor blacks and looters were murdering innocents and terrorizing whoever crossed their path in the dark, unprotected city. That's what we heard. Not true. Now, finally, as I say, the facts are coming out. Today, a clearer picture of post-Katrina violence is emerging, and it is an equally ugly one, including white vigilante violence, not just poor black people, police killings, official cover-ups, and a suffering population far more brutalized than many were willing to believe. And Harry Scherer in this documentary, The Big Uneasy, has got some footage about that, too. And a few whistleblowers from the Army Corps of Engineers are in it, too. Several police officers and a white civilian accused of racially motivated violence have recently been indicted in various cases, and more incidents are coming to light. 4 years later, as the Justice Department, under Barack Obama, has started several investigations into civil rights violations after the storm. So at the end of this, Jacques Morial, a co-director of the Louisiana Justice Institute, a nonprofit advocacy organization, and the son of New Orleans' first black mayor, said, "We were dismissed as kooks for the last 4 years. I think what we are seeing now recalibrates the reality of Katrina, and I think it vindicates lots of folks." So more balanced view we had to have. We just hope it's not going to happen again. I don't think we're going to have a flood in Detroit. But from what I've read in another study, just came out last week, the $350 million in levees and dikes that were put up by the Army Corps of Engineers after Katrina, they're not going to hold. They're not going to be adequate, even for a lesser hurricane. That's a report of objective people. So why did we spend $350 million for something that's not going to work? Of course, my plan, always with an alternative idea, was to bring as many people as possible from New Orleans to Detroit and give them like a fourth or a third of the city, because we got the space, and let them have a mini New Orleans. Because it's not going to flood in Detroit. And so let them start. I mean, $350 million, we could have relocated, you know, everybody that was in New Orleans to another place, like we've got room in Detroit. And imagine, we could have had, you know, talk about cultural time. You talk about Greek town. We could have New Orleans town. You know, I mean, but of course I know the people are connected to the right. to the Gulf and right. now the oil locale. Spill. I guess they still feel connected. I don't know. The culture, the atmosphere, the humidity is different up here. But, you know, I think a theme town within a town could have worked for me, because the Army Corps of Engineers doesn't have an idea how to do this, and they didn't help out at the start. So a lot of people to take blame, but we have to have a good picture about how to handle disasters of this sort, you know, in the future. So listen up in the next 4 hours when we say you can call in. Joanne Korchinska and myself will be giving out those three pairs of tickets for the 7 p.m. showing of The Big Uneasy at Birmingham Theater this coming Monday night. What else do we want to conclude with, Amy and Dennis?
Well, you handed me earlier.
Okay, sure.
You can take a look at that.
Yeah, you didn't want to read from the paper?
You're on a roll.
Her eyes are tired today.
So. Yeah.
It says, "Dear Jay." Oh, that's me. This is from Monica Patel Ecology Center, which is based in Ann Arbor. They have taken up many, many battles legally to get to save our environment. And she says, "When I joined the fight," I interviewed her on the show a couple of years ago. She says, "When I joined the fight against new coal plants in Michigan, there were 8 proposals on the table. Imagine how happy I was to read this headline in Detroit Free Press this week." This week, folks. I don't know which day it was, but coal-fired plant rush burns out. A little pun there. The rush burns out. Of the 8 proposals, Monica goes on to say, "You and I work most directly on Wolverine Power Supplies proposal in Rogers City and Consumers Energy proposal in their Bay City. We wrote to our Michigan representatives and public decision-making agencies. We testified." She uses that "we" there to make me feel good, but she's sending the same email to everybody. I think I signed a petition via email. You know, that's all I did, folks.
Maybe you're the only one.
No.
All right.
We testified in person, well, I didn't, but she did anyway, during public comment period, signed statewide petitions and more. In short, we refuse to let the coal barons push more ancient technology and pollution on our struggling state. One of our key next steps, she says, is to make sure coal ash regulation for existing sites protects Michigan residents. So the coal plants we've got, like the one that's in Detroit now, generating most of our electricity in the Detroit area, is still spewing coal ash. So the United States Environmental Protection Agency is holding a critical hearing in Chicago on September 16th, and she says, we encourage you to join us in person. I need a trip to Chicago. Oh, Sierra Club is providing a free bus.
There you go.
All right.
We're all set.
Field trip.
We'll pack you. You know,
they talked
brown
about
bag
that too.
Lunch.
Boy,
is that a Friday? I could call in from Chicago. Yeah. While I'm eating deep dish pizza.
Yeah, but we'll be with
you.
We'll be here.
Oh, yeah. Well, you go in place for me like you usually do. Anyway, or to submit your comments as soon as possible. That's Monica Patel Ecology Center based in Ann Arbor. You can go to their website, which is ecocenter.org. So. We're going to, with all the parking problems here at the college this week, it's a new semester. It is WHFR Dearborn you're listening to. Probably our podcast will go another minute or two, so we've got a little more time. Joanne has not arrived in the studio yet because I bet her favorite parking spot is occupied right now. So she's driving around a little bit. But I thought I would mention, well, there's a couple of things here. I don't know which is going to take the less time. Well, it's another segue. There's another movie that in New York Times today, Thomas Friedman talks about, and he says, steal this movie too. It was a book.
Steal this book.
Written by a yuppie. Can't remember the name, Paul Krasner, or no, someone else years ago. And just talked about the youth revolution and peace and justice for everybody and so on. And the book didn't sell very well in the newsstands because everybody stole it. That was what the title said, steal this book. So they did. But nonetheless, this movie is a great movie done by the same person who directed Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth.
Nice.
And it's entitled Making It with Superman. And I can't find my sheet on it right now. Oh, well.
Well, you'll find...
Making It with Superman. And it's about education. Education and how we can improve it. Now, for our Canadian listeners, they probably already know this. What country has one of the best public educational systems in the world? In the top two or three? Not us. No, it's Canada.
Yeah. Hmm.
Okay. This is public education, folks, for everybody. Okay, rich, poor, public education, and they have the best. Well, how do they do it? Well, it's interesting, but as it was said for many years by people like myself who teacher type.